Welcome to season four of The Culture of Kindness. My name is Nahala Summers and I am your host. A culture of kindness is based on the idea that by bringing kindness into leadership, we reduce stress, anxiety, make happier workplaces, and in turn, improve the bottom line for any organization or institution. It is a book, leadership program, accreditation, and of course, this wonderful podcast. Kindness has been my life's work since I founded the social movement for kindness back in 2012 called Sunshine People. And it has kept me interested on what people have to say on the complexities of kindness ever since. The guest lineup is exceptional, from politicians to social media influencers, best-selling authors to BBC presenters, an eclectic mix of people who all have completely different views on kindness, how we get it, and where the world is currently at. If you enjoy this episode, then please do show your support for kindness by subscribing to the podcast, leave a five-star review, or simply invest in the book, aptly named A Culture of Kindness, available on Amazon. Thanks so much. I hope you enjoy. Jazz, thank you so much for coming on and being a guest on A Culture of Kindness. I think I'm so excited to speak to you, and because everything that you're doing, everything that you're representing is everything that I'm talking about right now and saying, how do we make this different? Because this seems to me to be the absolute epitome of unkindness in society and the way that we live. I could talk about where do we start? I don't know where to start, really. I guess do an overview for anyone who hasn't already heard about you and your work, because there were lots of things that have kind of gone very big for you. Kind of talk a little bit about that journey, and then maybe we can deep dive into some of the things that are going on in the world right now.
Sure. So I am the founder of an organization called the Worldwide Tribe, and that started, crazily enough, 6.5 years ago now in 2015, very organically and accidentally. So it was at a time when, similarly to now, the media was quite negative around migration, refugees, asylum seekers. You know, we were seeing lots of negative, dehumanizing headlines at the time. And my mum and dad were actually going through a personal process of trying to look into taking on another child into the family. So they already had four of us. I'm the oldest of four biologically, and they were worried about having no kids at home anymore because my youngest brother was going to uni or moving out anyway. And so they were looking into their options. And it turned out that there were a lot of unaccompanied minors arriving to the UK, not too far from us where they live in Kent. Lots of people were arriving from Calais at the time and crossing into Kent. And that included a lot of children who were arriving alone. And so my mum and dad were very open to taking on a child who didn't speak English or who was a little bit older or a boy. And these are some of the things that lots of other families maybe don't want, right? And so it looked likely that my new little brother or sister would be coming via this camp in Calais, the notorious jungle camp. And it basically led me to go there before my first foster brother Mez joined my family. I went to Calais to try and find out a little bit more, to try and find out a little bit about the human side of the story, why people were leaving their countries, the countries that they were leaving from. These are the kinds of things that I couldn't find in our media at the time. It was a curiosity that brought me there, really. And what I was met with there was really, really life-changing and eye-opening and completely different from the way that it had been portrayed in the media. So what I met was met with huge kindness when I arrived. Many incredible people with incredible stories. I basically, to cut a long story short, wrote about that first trip, saying that the people that I'd met there, you know, were cold at night, they were hungry during the day, they didn't have their basic needs covered. There were no volunteers working in the camp at the time from the UK. There were a couple of French local volunteers. a lady called Maya, who is my absolute, the best example of kindness that you could ever possibly imagine. Anyway, I wrote about that camp on Facebook, and since then we've used social media, Instagram and Facebook, and lots of kind of different avenues to tell a different story and to raise funds and to organize distributions, but also to share and amplify voices of people and stories that are otherwise often going untold. Yeah. We do that through talks, we do that through our podcast, through films, through writing. And in that time, over the last 6 years, I now have 4 foster brothers who came to the UK as unaccompanied minors, Mez being the first one. And he does lots of talks with me and lots of events with me because he's 20 now and speaks very beautifully about his country and his country, Eritrea, and the reason why he left and the crazy journey that he took across the Mediterranean, across Europe, you know, hiding underneath the Eurotunnel train to get to the UK alone, aged 13. It's quite mind-blowing what he experienced. And subsequently, I have an Afghan brother, a Sudanese brother, and a Libyan brother, who is the youngest and might actually be coming home from school anytime soon, so might even make a cameo on this podcast. But he... has been in the UK pretty much only during lockdown for the last year and a half or so. And they are my constant inspiration, really, for continuing to do what I do and continuing to do everything I can to try and tell that different story, to give a bit of a different perspective and to, as I say, highlight some of these incredible people and stories and voices that I believe that the whole world needs to hear.
Yeah. Absolutely. Anyone just listening to that, nobody is not going, wow, that is the epitome of connection and kindness and where we need to be. You talked about the dehumanizing of the media. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated, you know, do we see anything different coming for refugees, for humans? You know, where do you see our media right now having an influence on the way that we interact?
I see a huge influence from our media, even in the response from our own community through the Worldwide Tribe. We have now formed this incredibly strong, big community of people who support refugees and asylum seekers. But the way that we share online is still very impacted by what's going on in the media, right? And that, you know, has seen a pendulum of support, whether, you know, it increases when something happens in Afghanistan, for example, last August, when the Taliban, during the Taliban takeover, we see a huge increase in empathy and support and love and action. But then the media will change, the stories will change, people's, I guess, attention will move on and we'll see a little bit of a lull again. And maybe we'll see a little bit of negativity when we're hearing stories, hostile stories coming out in our news about people arriving here across the channel, about the idea that we're being invaded or overrun or that we're running out of space or that our resources are limited or stretched, you know. And so whatever's going on in the media, we really kind of see the ripple effects of that in our work and in the support of our work.
You talk about that crossing, you know, that made big news. I mean, there's probably a lot of things that happen that do not make the news for whatever reason, but that just blew up, really. And what do you think the impact was? I mean, I know that the media will tell a story, but does everybody follow it? Do you feel that the media really did influence it and say, you know, there's always blame within the media, isn't there? Was the politicians being blamed? Were the people in the boats being blamed? You know, people died then. And it's very difficult to say, oh, it's the person's fault, you know, as it became a political thing. What was your take on that kind of time and that story, really?
Are you talking about the 27 people that died in November crossing
That's
the channel?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry.
Well, you know, Nala, what's really interesting is that people have been crossing the channel this way for years, and it is very interesting to see how in the last couple of years it's kind of really appeared in our media. And at the same time, you know, some would say at the same time as other things that are happening, other things that are being pushed through and that we are being distracted from, right? And what else is going on that maybe we are to kind of just, yeah, distract our attention from, I guess. So I really feel that our media, our politicians currently are using this small group of vulnerable people as scapegoats, that the amount of people arriving across the channel, whether that be in boats or in the back of lorries or however, is tiny. The amount of people that make up the population of refugees and asylum seekers in the UK is less than 1%. I think it's less than 0.1%. Anyway, regardless, it's a tiny, tiny percentage. And we absolutely are not being overrun. You know, this is definitely a fallacy, a lie that we are being told. In terms of other European countries, we are absolutely not doing our bit when it comes to welcoming and accepting refugees and asylum seekers and the amount that we take. I mean, as a Brit, just think about how many Eritreans you might know or how many Sudanese or Syrians you might know. I'm guessing that it's quite a small number, if any. And so using these people who are actually seeking safety and security and fleeing the world's worst atrocities as scapegoats, it's a really cruel thing to be doing. And I really recognize that that is what's happening at the moment. And it's frustrating because, as I say, anyone who actually hears directly from the people that are making these journeys, you know, you would understand and you would recognize that anybody in that situation would do the same. There's a lot of myths happening, a lot of kind of headlines being put out there, a lot of ideas that, you know, refugees aren't real refugees if they're not staying in the first safe country, for example, if they're crossing through France or they're crossing through countries that we in the West deem to be safe. But again, this shows such a lack of empathy and understanding and awareness and education, because although France might be safe for you or I, it's not safe as an unaccompanied minor because of the numbers of asylum claims there. It's much more difficult to get your asylum accepted. People are they're deported back to Eritrea, back to Sudan. You know, even in the UK, we've been deporting people back to Afghanistan for years and years. My own Afghan brother, whose whole family were killed by the Taliban, his asylum was denied and he was given a date to be sent back to Kabul until we appealed it and we were successful. But yeah, so there are tented communities, camps in France in a way that we don't see here. And that isn't safe as an unaccompanied minor, as a kid alone, to be living in a camp in Calais on the streets in Paris without the support of social services, for example, in the UK that do actually house you purely because of the numbers, right? It's a lot more difficult to get to the UK than it is to mainland Europe because you have to cross that piece of water that, as you have seen, is very, very dangerous. So yes, I think there are a lot of misconceptions out there that through stories we're trying to really just penetrate a little. And when people hear this directly from Mez, for example, the reason why he made it to the UK, the reason why he took the journey that he did, I really feel that once you've heard it from him, you wouldn't deny him the same opportunity that, you know, we all deserve, and that's to be safe.
That is astonishing that it was your brother, right? Mm-hmm. One of your brothers who had to go, his whole family was not there. They had been killed and we denied him the chance, even though he was safe. We were going to send him back to a country where there was nobody there. And he was a young person. I mean, there is really something wrong when that happens. There's something wrong with our system, the humankind. There's something about this whole borders thing, and this is my space that has grown and got more concerning. You know, I recognize that it's always from fear, but wow. You touched then on, you know, something I talked to you briefly before we jumped on the podcast about this kind of, I'm going to make lots of noise over here about nothing in particular. In the media, the politicians are making noise about it. We saw it in COVID. You know, COVID was in the news, even to the point that people were like, okay, we're done with hearing about COVID now, because we just don't, we know it's there. We know what we've got to do, enough. Mm-hmm. But they still carried on. And while they were doing that, there was these bills passing through, stuff going through Parliament, being agreed, that has continued to go on. And it's not just one thing, it's many, many things. But one of those was something that you highlighted actually in your Instagram, and anyone who's not following your Instagram, I strongly recommend it, was the Nationality and Borders Bill. Mm-hmm. Do you want to just share a little bit more about that and what impact that will then have on everybody, really? What impact will that have?
Yes, absolutely. So the Nationality and Borders Bill is part of the hostile environment policy, and some of the things that are now being passed as a result of it, as part of it, are that, for example, your citizenship, your British citizenship, can be revoked at any time, which is hugely scary. And it allows the government power to remove British citizenship without any notice, and also it criminalises asylum seekers and humanitarian rescue missions also. So currently, under international law, it's not illegal to seek asylum in whichever country you choose. But the Nationality and Borders Bill actually means that refugees and asylum seekers arriving to the UK can face up to, I think it's 3 years in prison, which is very, very scary. And another aspect of it to highlight, I guess, is that it also grants immunity to border force if people die at sea during these pushback operations. So border force are pushing boats back into French waters so that they don't arrive. Basically, to seek asylum in the UK, you need to be on British soil. This violates the Refugee Convention by pushing people back and out of British waters, and also the fact that it puts them in danger doing so. So yes, that's another common misconception, Nala, that is, I'm really glad that you raise, is that currently you need to be on British soil to seek asylum in the UK. And there is, you know, this rhetoric happening in the news, and I see it sometimes on social media, that people should come here legally. If they want to seek asylum, they should come here legally. But there are no legal routes for many, many people. The legal routes are so minor and minuscule. You know, it's a few thousand Syrians a year, for example, but there are no options if you're from Eritrea, if you're from Sudan. There is no legal way. There is no paperwork or embassy or documents that you can fill out to come here legally. Mez, my brother, my Eritrean brother, he has a brother in Eritrea, and there is no legal way that his younger brother can join him here in the UK. Even if my family say he can live here, we will support him, there's no way. He still has to cross the sea in the way that we've seen in unsafe boats, the Sahara, Libya, the jungle in Calais. You know, there's no other option for him, even as a child. So I think that's something to really highlight as well, that people wouldn't be doing this journey if there was a legal option.
No. People are literally dying to keep themselves alive. And, you know,
how ironic is that?
Yeah. I mean, it is shocking, isn't it? Absolutely is the epitome of everything that is not right with the world, isn't it, really?
When it seems so clear to me, but yeah, it's crazy that still so many people, for some reason, do feel this kind of hostility and support the government's hostile environment policy when, yeah, for me, it seems so clear that where is the compassion and the kindness for the people that need it most?
Yeah. Do you think, you know, obviously there are countries at the moment that are literally falling apart. You know, there is this as we know in Afghanistan, you know, countries that are just imploding and everybody's becoming dispersed and seeking some sort of asylum. And I think changing the word of asylum to safety, because actually I think every human deserves to feel safe. And nobody could ever deny that. Nobody could ever say that every human does not deserve to feel safe in their life. And so, you know, these different countries, as they fall apart, how do you, you know, do you have a thought on what we should or what we could be doing to bring safety to people in their countries? How do we fix that? Or is there just that it's too broken now? Those countries are too broken.
I mean, I think that it would be amazing if I had a solution and that every single country is unique in its situation. I would like to speak to what you just said about the semantics that we use, that absolutely it seems that within our society we have lost the meaning of asylum, and an asylum seeker is literally someone who is seeking safety. And absolutely, I think you're so right that if we replace that word, and actually if we replace the term asylum seeker for person or human or mother or father or son or daughter or brother or sister, because every single one of these people is someone's son or daughter, right? And that's so important to consider the language that we use, that language like illegal immigrant or migrant is so loaded now that it makes it easy for us to not relate. And we might not relate to the word refugee or asylum seeker, but I think we all know what it feels like to be in pain, to struggle, to be in a moment in your life where you need support, where you need help. And what would you want for yourself in that situation? What would you want for your family when they're in their darkest moments, you know, or something that's happened to them that's out of their control? Mm. And that's something that I really encourage, is let's actually, as I say, replace these terms for ones that maybe we do relate to a little bit more. Yeah. But yeah, in answer to your question, unfortunately, I don't have any answers for how to make things better in places like Afghanistan. But I would say that it's important to see our involvement and recognize the involvement of the West. For example, my Libyan brother, he always says that had our countries not meddled in the situation in his country, then he wouldn't have to come here, right? And recognizing that, I think, is really important too.
And taking that feedback and information from those people that have managed to get here and but have seen why the country fell apart, truly fell apart, not because of what we're hearing in the media, I think is an incredibly important lesson to how we see the world. But as you say, you know, we're only hearing bits and pieces, you know, in the media. Classic example, you know, you highlight on your Instagram about the tennis player with Novak, I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name without getting it wrong and then coming across as being rude, but you know, tell us about that story. You know, you highlighted it and I'm just fascinated because it's not the story that's been in the news.
Yes, I think it's always really great to, I guess, piggyback off the things that are in the news and try and amplify the story that we want to tell, right? So it's been in the news this week that Novak Djokovic, world's number one tennis player, has been detained in a hotel called Park Hotel, a detention facility in Melbourne, upon arriving in Australia and not having met their immigration requirements, right? And that part is all kind of irrelevant, because what I've been trying to highlight as a result is that he was joined, or he was in Park Hotel alongside 33 asylum seekers who have been detained for up to 9 years in Australia. So we've heard this last couple of weeks from a couple of the people inside, young people inside, two young men who are 23 and 24 that have both been detained in Australia since they were children. And these guys have not committed a crime, right? They haven't done anything wrong, but they have spent their rest of their teenage years and their early 20s, their youth, in detention, in rooms in the Park Hotel that have no access to fresh air. And they are served, you know, pictures that have come out of food with maggots in it, moldy bread. It's really, really crazy to see. So we've been trying to highlight some of these stories of the people that are in that exact same hotel that has lots of attention at the moment for the reason of, you know, the world's press are surrounding it. But let's actually, I guess, not forget about the 33 people that continue to be detained there long after, and will continue to be long after, Novak Djokovic being released. So he spent 5 days in detention in Australia, right? And on average, undocumented migrants in Australia spend 689 days detained. So I think that's just something to remember now that, yeah, this story has kind of had some coverage.
That is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? So much I want to say, really, but... you know, it's interesting because as you were talking then, I was thinking, I wonder if every person in the UK or the Western world, for that matter, who lives in safety and has lived in safety for their entire life, was to stand in the shoes and say, imagine for a moment that their homes and towns and villages and everything around them was bombed and they were left in nothing. And there continued to be a worn, torn UK, which may seem impossible. Oh, well, it won't happen to us. But just imagining that it did, those people would be getting on those boats and they'd be heading over to France to seek some safety. And I find it astonishing that more people in the UK are unable, those people who are so hateful that they're unable to stand in those shoes and go, it could be us. That could have been my child in that situation, but we picked a lucky card and were born in a good country. And that's just what keeps going round in my head, really, that idea that we just don't really have a grip on standing in the shoes for somebody else. A lot of your work is about empathy, isn't it? It's about sharing stories.
Exactly that. I shared a quote recently by my friend Hassan Akkad, who is a Syrian activist and filmmaker. And he said, I can personally testify to the fact that conquering prejudice is all about education, that people are afraid of what they don't understand. And that really underpins, you know, the reason why we do the work that we do at the Worldwide Tribe and try to not change people's minds, but provide them with the information so that they can make an informed decision. Because as I say again, like, I truly believe that if people did meet Mez or Hassan or hear any of these incredible stories firsthand, then how can we deny people, exactly as you say, like, safety in the same way that we have? There's no difference between us. Yes, okay, we might not be able to relate to the UK going to war, but we know what it feels like for things to happen outside of our control and you know, governments to make decisions that maybe we don't agree with. And yeah, really practicing that empathy, really practicing, okay, what would that feel like? I read this amazing study that was rolled out in a school, I think in New York, where a private school in a very affluent area met with a group of students from a school from a low-income area. And they basically did this practice of empathy, right, where they told each other their stories and details about home life or their families or their upbringing. And then they told each other their stories back to them, but in the first person. And the results that they saw from this experiment was amazing, because it doesn't take much for us to really, like, feel and connect with somebody who might be different from us. But it takes a little bit of effort on both parts. And when you do, it's really eye-opening and beautiful. And actually, what's more amazing in this world than connecting with people that are different from us and learning. And, you know, we embrace that so much in so many ways when it comes to food or music. Or, and what would the UK, for example, be if we didn't have those waves of immigration from the last decades before us, economically or gastronomically or like culturally, you know, without all of that? Isn't our national dish chicken tikka masala? I mean, like, there's so much influence from other countries that we totally welcome and embrace and celebrate. And I really feel that celebrating our differences and recognizing our similarities is the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody should be following you. The Worldwide Tribe is where to find you. And of course, then you also have your own page as well. Completely moved. Anybody who's listening to this who isn't completely moved, I'll be very, very surprised. I always end on the same question at the end, which is, what does a culture of kindness mean to you, and what does it look like in your world?
What a beautiful question. And to me, that is an open heart, being welcoming, you know, in whatever way that looks to you, whether that be towards the elderly couple that live next door to you, the new family in your area. You know, it doesn't need to be refugees and asylum seekers, but just actually extending a hand of welcome in whatever way and whatever capacity that you can, because truly we have a lot to gain from that. You know, for me, it's brought me to new places and meeting new people, and even having four new brothers that have totally enhanced and made my life better in every single aspect and element. And I think that, yeah, recognizing ourselves in others, because underneath the things that divide us, like nationality or religion or gender or race or all those superficial things, you know, we all want for the same basic needs. And at the end of the day, when you strip all that back, like, we all want the love of the people around us and connection with other human beings, and, you know, everything else, it doesn't matter. So we're working towards it, Nala. Yeah.
Well, you're doing a great job, and I am sure that everybody who listens will be following. And never has there been a greater culture of kindness that you are generating. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing, Jazz, and highlighting. And I'll certainly be following the journey and keep in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have loved this episode, please do share it with others. Pop on and give a lovely review, but mostly take forwards into your life something that can change someone else's. We are looking for the elusive happiness, and kindness is the action that can get us there.